welcome back to Resurrections, an Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast. I'm your host, Al Sedano. And as you might have seen from the title of this episode, we are in the middle of crossover land again, this time participating in the JL April crossover, which means no Adam or Thanos today, but we have monkeys. We got monkeys. And if we got monkeys, Tim Price can't be far behind. Hello, Tim.
I can't believe how often I've heard that. It's like such a common thing.
The cliche.
Monkeys and Tim Price is right behind. Hello, Al. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm a mess. Which is always what you want to hear from your podcast guest. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Well, have we had our lovely recording for JL April ourselves? We discussed the 1992 miniseries Angel and the Ape. So that was a great recording and great fun to have that discussion. But yes. In the meantime, before this recording, I was directing a play for community theater and the production went on. And it's now been a week since the show finished and I still feel like a basket case. So, you know. It's just one of those things. Well, I might go ape myself.
Considering the issues we're reading today, basket case kind of fits.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. But still looking forward to having this discussion and talking about these particular issues because they were quite the hoot.
Yes. So in case anyone hadn't realized, if you checked through on my social media, I would have already put links into Tim's episode on his feed, where, like you said, we talked about the 92 Angel of the Ape miniseries as part of this crossover. And so we decided to, for this episode of the crossover, have him back over here, and we would talk about the first appearances of those characters. So Angel and the Ape, obviously, which is in showcase number 77, but also the Inferior Five, since they are a big part of that miniseries, which we'll be covering next after that, from showcase 62. And also, briefly, the appearance of the MacGuffin, from that miniseries, which we found out during the recording, was a pre-existing thing. The Green Glob from Tales of the Unexpected, number 83.
I still can't believe that's a pre-existing thing. I'm still just blown away by that concept.
I did not. I mean, I bought that stupid miniseries when it came out, and I've read it many times. And I never even thought that maybe could be something pre-existing.
Yeah, the way it was introduced and the tie-in that they made in the story to the Green Lanterns was like, okay, he just made up a thing.
I mean,
and didn't make up a thing? It's like,
he just adapted
still,
a thing.
I still can't fathom it.
He adapted a fit because it wasn't part of the Green Lanterns originally, but
he adapted
whole cloth.
And which was the whole thing about all that series was doing too, was a lot of things were being adapted, kind of moving him into the DCU that way. So absolutely.
And that's the kind of the thing to remember. It's like you think about things, you know, reading comics then, reading comics now, and there's always plus and minuses for both. And one of the pluses now is, like, back then, I read that. Unless I had read those Tales of the Unexpected or knew somebody else who had read the same Angel of the Ape miniseries and also had read those Tales of the Unexpected, really no way to know.
Oh, yeah.
But this time, I just happened to be looking on the wiki page for it and for that miniseries and going, hey, there's a thing to click on for Green Glob. Oh my God, that is a pre-existing thing. And that's kind of cool.
That's crazy.
That was not an option that existed back in 92.
Right. Back in the day, we couldn't do your clickings on the internet.
We had to look it up in the book. Which was the style at the time.
You had to look things up like a caveman. Ridiculous.
You had to know where to look things up.
Right. Yeah. Well, and when it comes to comics, like the resources on that historical information was few and far between.
Exactly.
So it's like, you know, between the fact that we can look things up on the internet and if they're posted to, you know, either Marvel Unlimited or the DCU Infinite app, you can actually read them. Is just insane. Now, none of these books are available there, but, you know, because
find them some other way.
Yeah, because, you know, DC just, you know, doesn't love joy. I guess that's all it is. They don't love joy.
They don't want more of my business. But yes, so that is what we are going to be covering today. The first appearances of those three things, mostly focusing, of course, on Angel and the Ape, since, well, that was the Angel and the Ape miniseries we covered. And of course, this is Jail April, not Jail Inferior 5 roll.
Right. Or Jail Glob.
And plus, those don't roll off the tongue as easily.
Jail Glob. No, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. And that's just a little glob. Just a little glob. Just like a drop, just a dollop. It's a green dollop today.
I mean, we might be able to get away with it if we were doing Slimer Month or something.
Ah, true. That's very true.
But then we'd also be doing Ghostbusters issues, so. But anyway, enough of that. So hold on a sec, people. I'm going to drop in a synopsis for Showcase number 77. Probably put a little promo in here, and then we will be right back to talk all about it.
Showcase number 77. Cover dated September 1968. On sale date July 25th, 1968, with a cover price of 12 cents. Cover art Bob Oxner, Sergio Aragonés, Tex Blaisdell, and Gaspar Saladino. Written by one, both, all three, maybe none of these people. It's a sort of a bit of a mystery. We will be talking about this in the episode, don't worry. The suspects are E. Nelson Bridwell, Howie Post, and Al Jaffe. Pencils by Bob Oxner. Inker, Tex Blaisdell. Colorist is unknown. Letters, Ray Holloway. And editor is Joe Orlando. And this will be the part where I would normally give the synopsis for the issue, but I realized when editing the episode that Tim and I actually pretty much give the synopsis as we go. So, kind of be redundant to have it here as well. So, listen to the rest of the episode, you'll get the synopsis. All right, let's put a promo in here and then get back to me and Tim.
Dinosaurs, purple skies, motorcycles, the hero who cries, all on covers of comic books that sell the best. But what sells more than the rest? Monkeys, covers with monkeys. Yes, you know you gotta stock the monkeys. Hey, hey, stock the monkeys. Hey, hey. Celebrating the tradition of apes in comics. For 2024, Gorilla Grodd has transformed JL May into JL April. Honestly, he does that a lot. Exploring a phylum of amazing apes, such as
Batman Annual number 23,
Wonder Woman number 170,
Kong on the Planet of the Apes, issue 1,
Angel and the Ape,
The Helmet of Fate, Detective Chimp,
Showcase number 77,
JLA versus Godzilla versus Kong,
Swamp Thing volume 2, annual 3,
Kong Gorilla, issues 1 through 4,
with a host of podcast all-stars like
The Bat Pod,
Resurrections, an Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast,
Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast,
Dolph a Flanger,
The Quarterbin podcast,
Coffee and Comic,
Once Upon a Geek,
Fanholes podcast,
Married with Content with John and Maggie,
Campus Comics Cast,
and many more. Look for the hashtag JLApril2024 on social media, the podcast crossover event that doesn't monkey around. Really? Monkey around? This is what you're giving me? I don't know why I agreed to this.
Stick to the script, monkey boy!
And we're back. Okay, so showcase number 77. So, as I mentioned in the synopsis, so this cover, which is a fun cover, we have somebody staggering into the O'Day and Simeon private investigator's office with like an arrow sticking out of his coat.
Yes.
An angel sitting there almost like modeling, saying, "Drop the pen, Sam. I have a feeling our first case is here." You could just see Sam's hands as he's drawing a comic strip.
Right.
Now, while it was penciled by Bob Oxner, apparently Sergio Aragonés, a.k.a. creator of Gru, is credited with having the cover idea.
Wow. That's pretty great.
A little pedigree there already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and when we get into this a bit more, and the artists on both of the showcase issues we're going to talk about feels like they have a lot of crossover with Mad Magazine. And there's definitely a feel of this fitting in right very well side by side with Aragonés in Mad, you know, seeing the kind of things he would have done there. Well, it that feels also, very, it feels very consistent with that sort of craziness and just the volume of detail and gags, visual gags that are included on everything. So yeah, I believe this totally.
Because the writer is, it's unsure. Looks like it's pretty certain that E. Nelson Bridwell did the plot. And I'm pretty certain Bridwell did work for Mad.
Yes, that sounds right. Mm-hmm.
But as for the script itself, it might have been him, it might have been Howie Post, or Al Jaffe.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so according to what I'm seeing here, comics.org, it says, there's no definite conclusion on who wrote the story. In Amazing World of DC Comics number 10, in There's No Cases Like Showcases, Jack C. Harris wrote, Orlando was up again with Angel and the Ape by E. Nelson Bribble, Al Jaffe, Bob Oxner, and Tex Blade-Aisel, with a cover idea of Sergio Aragonés.
Mm-hmm.
So they say that. Now, and then it says, in the letter column of Venture Comics 414, when a fan remembers Angel and the Ape, E. Nelson Bridwell replied, that was a creation of publisher Carmine Infantino, Joe Orlando, and yours truly, with Bob's art. And on the drawing board, number 67, credits Bridwell of plot and Howie Post of script. So, who knows?
We'll just say it was a team effort.
Yes.
Most definitely a team effort. Well, let's talk about this cover a little bit. We can talk about this cover a little bit more, too.
Oh, right ahead.
It's great that, you know, they have the typical office door with the letters on it for O'Day and Simeon, private investigators. And as the man is falling through and just very torn up. One thing to note in the cover image that he's just wearing two pairs of shoes. That will be different on the inside. We'll get something very different on the inside, but that's just a little tidbit. And the image of that guy falling, his scream there is is a very comic looking yell there.
Yes.
Sam is drawing, and you can see that he's drawing a comic strip, and it, like, the first panel has an ape. The second panel has a woman wearing a bikini, it looks like. And that's, it's actually very cute little drawing there. But then also you see Sam's hands, you can see very clearly the gorilla type of fingers with lots of wrinkles and detail and tons of hair on the back of the hands. So much hair on the back of the hands. Meanwhile, you also have that gun in a holster right above the board, right above the drawing board, just sitting there to make it clear that, yes, this is there's more going on here than just artwork. And Angel is sitting there on the chair in that very attractive pose with legs crossed, one hand on the hip. But her other hand is also holding what looks like a long whip or I think it's called a lead line from horseback riding.
Oh,
maybe?
Yeah, it could be that.
Maybe.
But she is using that in the story.
Yep, absolutely. And she's kind of like looking, she's very, you know, very fetching looking. And she's just like looking sideways at Sam saying, drop the pen, Sam. I have a feeling our first case is here. But also, there's a little bit of a dominatrix energy about her sitting there with a riding crop in her hand. You know, there's something about that. There's a little bit of a wink there, I think, to us readers It's like, this is not as innocent maybe as you think it is. Maybe no, she's just not, a little bit. A little bit.
She is not the damsel in distress.
No, no. But yeah, it's a it's definitely a memorable cover. There's a lot to it.
Although she is going to be a little slight, I don't know if it's, well, here's the thing. It may be an act or not, but she is portrayed as a bit more ditzy inside than she was in the miniseries.
Yeah, I have thoughts about that too. We'll get to that when we get into the story a little bit more. But yeah, there's definitely some inconsistencies there, but it's okay.
So let's get into that story. Our first page kind of does, and it does feel like a mad-ish story almost.
Mm-hmm.
Like this guy's in the cast, he's on crutches with his one foot in the cast, and he's just running down the street as literally everything is trying to kill him. There's a sword that goes flying by. There's someone hiding in a garbage can with a gun. And they shoot, they miss him, but they happen to shoot the image of a skull and crossbones into the fence. A missile goes after him. An axe. And then also it looks like a Stone Age axe come flying at him. And a cannonball, which he happens to all dodge.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But then the worst thing happens.
Well, and he's also wearing, like I said, one cast is on one foot. That's different from the cover image because he doesn't have the cast on the cover image.
Hmm. True.
Yeah. Anyway, so the worst thing happens. What's that?
Stairs. He has to climb up the stoop and then climb up the flight of stairs to get to their office. Why can't private eyes have ground floor offices like normal business people? And the other thing that, like you said, the mad feeling, it's not just all that little bits of everything trying to kill him, like, you know, someone shooting at him or throwing a knife, but, you know, missiles and cannonballs and Stone Age axes on his they got the little details like a mad, like on his cast, his little sticker, it says cast of thousands.
That's right.
But yeah,
they gotta throw those little absurdist details are what make this more of a mad magazine kind of issue.
He crawls into the office almost like the cover, except instead of on a stool, Angel is perched on the desk, and she's using that whip to kill flies.
Right. Which is crazy and skillful. And she's also she's not wearing the long pants, she's wearing a skirt.
Yes. But it kind of gives you an idea that, okay, this person does have skill if they're using this whip to kill multiple flies per panel.
Mm-hmm. And she also just comes across as like she couldn't care less what's going on. She's like, yeah. I'm here working. What do you mean someone's trying to kill you? Prove it.
That's great. Prove it. And then a shot goes off and shoots his hat off. How about that? Okay, I'll buy it. And we find out that, yes, she asked him if he's been up to anything unusual. And the only thing was he took his first vacation in 42 years skiing in Switzerland. And as we can see him basically flying through the air and not gracefully.
Mm-hmm.
That looks like me when I
stopped. Yeah.
That's how I stopped.
Oh, that's not good. That's not good stopping, Al. No, don't stop like that.
You can see the St. Bernard dog drinking out of his own little flask or the barrel that they keep around their neck.
Yep. Right.
Yeah, he broke his leg getting off the ski lift. And it was set by a nice Swiss doctor. But that's the only weird thing that's happened to him, new thing that's happened to him. And then everyone keeps trying to attack and kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sam shows up at the same time as Barney and Clyde, who go to kill him.
Barney and Clyde.
When did Bonnie and Clyde come out, the movie? Was that 70s or 60s?
Ooh, I don't know offhand. Now I want to look it up. But for some reason, I'm thinking the characters, the people would have been known before then. So yeah,
but this issue came out in September of 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the Warren Beatty, Faye Dunaway, Bonnie and Clyde movie came out in 67.
Yeah, so there's and more blatant parallel. Absolutely.
So that is obviously the reason for it, because
mm-hmm.
Yeah, Bonnie and Clyde were known before, but they definitely would have been in the consciousness still just then.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But Sam basically throws him out.
Right. I mean, one through the window.
Yes. With an upside down help as he's falling upside down. And the other down the stairs. And this is one of the things I wanted to know. It's like, okay, because in the miniseries, Sam just talks normally.
Right.
So mm-hmm. I didn't know how they're going to portray him here. But as of now, at least as of his first, you know, this first page he's on, he doesn't say anything yet. But he does mm-hmm. think in English.
Right. Yeah. So but then we get to, so we get to the next page. And now we see what how his communication works in that. He talks very much in something that is portrayed as being kind of the comical version of a gorilla talking or of someone of what we think of a person pretending to talk to a gorilla.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that's not very sensitive to gorillas. But then they'll correct it and show what he really said right below those right below those balloons.
And as we'll see throughout the story, most people don't understand him, except for whatever reason, Angel does know what he's saying.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and when I look closely, there is some parallel between his gorilla speak and the actual words that he's supposed to be saying. They're actually, they can map up pretty close. Not necessarily close enough to easily guess what he's saying, but they're pretty close. But also it's like, okay, I tried playing that game for a little bit. It's like, can I figure out what he's saying just by reading the other words? Like, no, that's way too hard. Never mind. So I stopped and just kept skimming him through.
And we see that Sam also, besides being part of the private investigator, is the comics working as an artist for comics is something that goes back to here, because that's in the first appearance. He mm-hmm. just wants to ink a page real quick before they get started on the case. Until a message tied to a brick gets thrown through the window and bounces off his head and makes him spill the ink all over.
Now, do you think the idea of Sam being a cartoonist is a little bit of a jab at somebody in the comics industry?
It is possible. Because I'm fairly certain the editor he's working for is definitely a jab at somebody in the comic industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also just think there's something there about he's an ape who's drawing the comic strips. And like maybe the artist himself has said, like, I can get any ape to draw like that one too many times. So he's decided, OK, I'm going to make this ape draw the comics.
Well. As we're going to see,
is it like making a commentary back upon the editorial staff or writers who have a bad attitude towards the artists? Is it trying like, you know, fine,
that,
I'll own it. And here we go.
My question is now, is it that or considering who the editor is supposed to be? Are they making fun of a particular person that works for that company?
Yes, it's very possible.
And maybe not for saying things like that, just to make fun of them because they're the competition.
Right. That's very possible.
But yeah, they have their warning note, which they really put some effort into this warning note.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they have skull and crossbone stamps on there. The death is written in different, you know, really big font.
Mm-hmm.
They even drew a little gravestone. They had fun with this note.
They worked really hard on it. It says, respectfully, your, and then an X. Yeah. They didn't say yours. It's got two R's on the end of your.
Your.
Oops. Oops. I don't know if that's intentional or not. If that extra R is intentional. That's weird.
So Sam goes to deliver. So the plan is Sam's going to go deliver his pages to Brain Picks magazines and she'll guard Mr. Trumbull.
Right.
And Sam Brain actually gets an English word out. He says, check.
Yeah, he does.
And then this is one of the things I mentioned before. So Angel, like we said before, Angel comes off as a little like almost out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like when she first tells Sam about this issue, she says, Sam, I hate to bother you with trifles, but we have a client who's marked for murder and other troubles. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't seem right. The art does not seem portraying her as like worried or concerned or like she's being sarcastic. Based on her body language and everything we've seen so far from her, she's just like, oh yeah, we have a client from her. We want to kill him. We should.
Yeah.
Right. But yet here, three guys show up to kill him, and Angel basically takes them all out by hand.
Right. Oh yeah. She's totally just knocking them all over the place. She does take even one of her shoes off and uses that to clunk a guy in the head.
Yeah. Well, they keep saying, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I said I was sorry. While Sam just sits there with banana watching, going, ooh, I could probably use some of this in my next chapter I'm doing.
So we get established, at least for sure, that Angel is very competent in fighting. And as we go through the story, it's like, I don't know if she's really supposed to be a bimbo sort of blonde. It's more like she's just a disinterested sometimes. Or it's maybe she's ADHD and she only pays attention when it's interesting.
But it almost seems like they took some of a bit of this characterization and just put it more towards the dumb bunny character.
Yeah. Well, and this is a thing of that. This is sadly like a trope of how portraying women in general.
Yeah. You know? Although I will say this, I can see why reading this and then let's say planning on using the Inferior Five, he might have gone, well, there's definitely similarities between her and Dumb Bunny.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. In these portrayals.
Yes. But anyway, once it's 3-on-1, she's beating the hell out of them, but one of them does get a good grab on her. So that's it. Sam, you know, gets annoyed. So he jumps
right.
in. But then the police show up because, you know, the police show up and say, what's going on? And Andrew just tells them, flying lessons, officer, as Sam's throwing them around. And it turns out that giving flying lessons without a license is against the law.
Who knew?
So Sam climbs up a building to get away. But climbing buildings without a license violates city code 34712. Nobody imitates King Kong unless he got a permit.
So I shouldn't be taking this comic book too seriously, right?
Pretty sure.
Okay, all right. I just want to check.
But yeah, he shows up, leaps over the buildings to get to his publisher, which apparently he's done before because someone says that gorilla must be late in his deadline again.
I'll say real quick that from this page, this really kind of cements more for me that Angel is kind of being sarcastic, but she's not being blatantly sarcastic. She's so smart. She's on top of all this. She's like three steps ahead of everybody here.
And that's another way to look at it, possibly, that she's so far ahead of us that.
Yeah. So she's more like everybody else is just catching up with her. So she's like bored waiting for them to get there.
Like, hurry
up. It's not a big deal. It's like, come on, come on. Like her saying very quickly, flying lessons, officer. Like, no problem.
Yes, yeah, that good. Quick just wit.
Quick wit. She's ahead of everybody here, including me. So here's
a part where Sam gets to his editor, Stan Bragg.
Oh, well, before we get there, so at the bottom of page 7, he climbs up and he says, alley-oop.
Oh, yeah.
And then he makes a reference to, hey, we should make a comic character like that. Maybe from a cape, maybe an ape man with a dinosaur, and too ridiculous. It's like, yeah.
In case anyone doesn't know, there is a classic comic strip named Alley Oop, which I've never read it, but I'm going to be fairly certain it probably featured all those things.
Oh, it absolutely did. I have read it, and yes, it does feature all those things.
But yeah, so like we said, he gets to his editor, and this is the part where I'm like, okay, I'm guessing I know who they're making fun of here, because the editor's named Stan Bragg.
Yeah.
Although visually,
it definitely does feel that way.
It feels like they're kind of making fun of Roy Thomas more.
Right.
Because he looks pretty young. He's got. I'm pretty sure Roy Thomas had blonde or almost like very light red hair back then, and this guy's red hair with glasses.
Right. Although, it could be.
Roy
it could
Thomas
be...
have a reputation for biting people. Because that's the first thing the editor does is bite Sam.
Right.
And beats him up, basically attacks him.
pretty sure that has now basis in reality. But this does feel like it could be also a combination of the two characters, that, you know, they're just kind of like doing an amalgam of those two, because, you know, Roy also was very much a Marvel guy.
Yeah.
So,
and here's where I was wondering about Sam, because Kirby's art, like, I remember reading things about, like, when Marvel was first starting up, and people, editors and stuff at DC were like, this is a horrible artwork. Like, they were calling it, like, Kirby stuff horrible.
Mm. You know?
They were like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. How the hell is this crap selling?
Right.
And based on things I've heard, pictures I've seen, descriptions of Kirby, especially when he was younger, I could see somebody, if they wanted to be a bit insulting, calling him, like, an ape.
Right. Yeah. I see what you're saying. But also, you know, from all the stories we've heard, you know, Kirby being called up by Nazis and then saying, like,
well, that's something like, story.
I'll meet you downstairs, and going downstairs to go to fight barehanded against, like, a small pack of Nazis who were outside the offices. It's like, no, Kirby's a badass. So it's like, again, he's a, that does kind of come across as like, oh, you big ape, you big gorilla.
That also puts into another thing into it is, did they mean it to be him? Because the question is, did they want to take a chance of him doing that to them?
Right.
I mean, I don't know. Even if I were in the competition, I didn't like his work, which is not true. I do. But, would I want to make fun of him enough that I would be worried about him wanting to beat the crap out of me? Do I want to piss him off?
Oh, goodness. Well, you know, also, during this one panel where Stan is pounding on Sam for no good reason, except to say, this is the only way to treat talent. Got sound effects like thunk, crunch, blam, bink, fod. Why fod? P-H-O-D. What?
Yeah, that's, well, there's a lot of weird ones.
That's funny. There you go. It's almost stands out because the other sound effects are so normal by comparison. I kind of almost want all of the sound effects to be out there, and then I wouldn't have noticed it.
And, you know, I didn't think of it until we were talking about it, but the assistant then, the kind of ditzy girl who does not realize that Sam is a gorilla, calls him a dreamboat.
Oh, yeah.
The short, dark hair.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Flo Steinberg?
Ooh, it could be.
I mean, that's why I'm wondering if it's supposed to be Kirby, because it kind of does fit the Marvel. You know what I mean? It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Another Marvel.
Now, granted, regular. They could also be not making fun of Kirby. They could be like, that's the only one that would be tough enough that'd be like fighting a gorilla. Not in the insulting sense, but in the sense of like, yeah, you're not. It's almost like not fighting a person if you're fighting Kirby. It's fight. You know, it's fighting something stronger than a person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But he does not like his pages of the gorilla because apparently he does not. He needs to get into the mindset of a gorilla. He does not know how to portray gorillas very well.
Which is hilarious. And then having Stan act out the gorilla thing, which sounds a whole lot like stories of Stan Lee physically acting out the superhero stories for the artists and saying, okay, now go draw that. There's a lot to that. Now, also, I'm looking at this middle panel of the artwork supposedly drawn by Sam on page 9 of the gorilla and the jungle girl. And it's like, dang, the jungle girl is attractive. No.
That's also pretty much Angel.
Yeah. And she's holding a banana and eating a banana. It's like, what are they? There's some stuff they're sneaking past the sensor. They're sneaking things past there. I'm sorry. They are not that innocent. I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
They're really playing games with the sensors here.
And you know what? I just thought of something. When did this happen? Let me look. Hold on. Maybe I'm going to see if I'm right or not. Mm. Oh, never mind. It was much later.
Okay.
I was thinking of the Gong Show.
Oh.
The Popsicle Twins.
Oh, no.
But that was, the Gong Show didn't start till 76.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Gong Show was much later. Yeah.
But I mean, I just thought, like, is that, like, are they kind of riffing on that?
Right.
But no, sure. they're just, who knows what was going on there. But yeah, that has nothing to do with it. I don't know. I'm just thinking now, I put links for in the show notes for things, but should I put a link for the Popsicle Twins in or no?
No. If people who care, they should go to the effort. If they should go to the effort.
I'm not going to help you with your lewd thoughts. I don't need help with mine. You need help with yours. That's your own problem.
Yeah. Well, it also doesn't help that in that same panel, there's the image of the gorilla is kind of like staring at the jungle girl, leaning in, hands kind of like in that ready to grab position.
To be fair, it could also be about the bananas.
And there's a slurp, sound effect. Oh, it's supposed to be the bananas, but, you know.
I know.
Wink, wink. Of course it's about the wink bananas.
I'm seeing things with the editor, not just the jumping around, but as he's doing it, he's like doing this bitch and not $10 of his salary, maybe even $20. And I know, especially at the time. Now, granted, Stan wasn't the one that made the paychecks, but Martin Goodman was cheap.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So it all kind of fits.
Well, and here's Stan is wearing a red and white striped shirt and blue star spangled pants. Kind of like Captain America.
And a Doctor Doom cape.
Yeah, and a Doctor Doom cape. It's a homage to Captain America's outfit, but definitely doesn't look like Captain America's outfit. But still, there's a lot there to make you go, yeah, yeah, Marvel, yeah, gotcha.
Yeah. But yeah, so you want a little Marvel parody right here.
Mm-hmm.
But Stan has enough, knocks everyone around. They realize, oh, I guess he does have the idea of what a gorilla would be like. And he jumps out the window and apparently is not too worried about Angel because he goes home.
First of all, let's talk about the secretary who says, golly, I hope he's not married. And her eyes are practically cross-eyed. So the big time coding of her being a ditz.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But she's cute. I mean, a lot of her depiction here is also very Betty and Veronica.
Yes.
She got that very much that look. So it's like she's, you know, she made it look adorable, but it's like, oh, they're going a little bit overboard to make her try to seem like a ditz. It's like, ugh, not sure about that. But yeah, so Sam goes home. You're right.
And
what
Sam
happens
has
there?
One hell of a place.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, those comic book artists, they make big bucks, right?
Yeah.
That's apparently how that works.
I mean, he's got like a 2-story apartment and like the second floor is just like it's just like a balcony, so it's like one big thing for him to like jump around in.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he has a tire hanging for him to sit on as he's painting and playing the guitar.
And there's a picture in the background while he's doing that, which has the caption, Alan Lives. And I don't know what that's referring to.
I have no idea. I mean, there's pictures of King. It looks like there's a picture of King Kong on the panel above.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I have no idea what Alan Lives.
Well, and next to King Kong, there's a picture that's of just a facial shot of a gorilla. It gives the little hint of there being a bonnet around the head of the gorilla. Is that supposed to be like evoking a mom image? Of like, here's a picture of mom.
Batman wouldn't help them, so now the team's on their own. Black Lightning, Geoforce, Halo, Katana, Looker, Metamorpho. People of power with a new purpose. They are the Outsiders.
The Outcasters continues its coverage of the Outsiders, and Mike W. Barr's team for the 80s has big changes on the way. With a new home, a new title, and coming soon, the Baxter series. You can find the show on Right On Network with your favorite podcatcher, or listen at thehuntresspodcast.com, and follow us on Twitter @BatOutcasters. because to live outside the law or on Twitter, you must be honest.
And when we're reading the other miniseries, I know that there was a picture that had a face shot of a gorilla in Sam's apartment, but it was really angry looking, like, rawr. But for some reason in my head, I think that one's supposed to say mom under it, but I know it doesn't because I looked at it for our previous coverage. But it feels like that's what it's like. It's supposed to be a picture of his mom just hanging in his apartment. So, yeah, this is crazy.
But apparently, Sam, forgetting what he was supposed to do to help out Angel, well, he gets called in by Angel. Sam, help, kidnapped Mr. Trouble's house, 22 Pine Road. Hurry over and eek.
Now she's pretending to be a monkey because she said eek. Oh, wait, no, she was screaming. That kind of eek. Never mind.
He tries to leave, but you can't get out without a good gag. So He has to slip down the stairs because they're being mopped.
Steps right on the bar of soap.
Falls headfirst into the pan of water, or the bucket of water, and knocks everyone over who came out to gawk, including the landlord and her husband.
But also misses the water moccasin that apparently the...
Yes, they're apparently coming, they're apparently in there.
Building attendant was taking care of.
He has to put a strainer in his tap.
Oh, lordy. Everybody's going to just get knocked all helter-skelter.
Yes. Everyone's speaking, eek, I'm moving out. You can't. You're the landlord.
Big mouth, you had to ruin it.
I'm the landlord, and she's my wife, and I say she could move.
There's also a little bit about that where one of the people in the apartment building has a towel that looks like it says Plaza Hotel on the towel. But also, he's wearing a toupee. He's blatantly wearing a toupee.
Yeah.
It's funny.
And then as Sam leaves, they're trying to figure out who that was because the landlord is mad because someone broke the rule. Whoever owns that hairy beast has got to move out. No college students allowed in my building. And I'm guessing this is also a little knock at some stuff, student things that have been going on over the years because Sam's thinking, how do you know I majored in violence at Columbia University?
Oh, yeah. Those college hippies. Well, this is 1968. So,
yeah, we're.
I think things are pretty much in full swing here in terms of this college protests. I think.
Yeah, I would say so.
They're gonna just get ramping up more from here for the Vietnam War. It's going to get even worse. So, yep, that's just funny.
But he makes his way through to the house by jumping off a lamppost, jumping on the roof of the bus, jumping on the roof of the taxi. And goes in to find this house completely trashed, which means either it's been foul play or maybe Trumbull just got a cheap decorator.
Yep, one or the other.
Not sure. He's not sure yet. But apparently he catches a scent and he follows it to the zoo. Or maybe he's getting a cold. And apparently Sam's supposed to be attractive here because not only is the Flo character into him, the seals are into him too.
Yes.
They're falling head over flippers for him.
Oh, Sam's got animal magnetism.
And finds the trap door. And meanwhile, we see Angel and Trumbull are being dumped, were dumped and tied up and dumped into a pit of cobras. Well, Trumbull wishes he brought Okarin to charm them.
Right.
Like, no. She's like, snakes are deaf. It's the, it's the movement that hypnotizes them.
Mm-hmm.
So she does a dance to try and hypnotize the snakes, and apparently it works on them. As they get like giant Looney Tune wolf eyes.
Yes.
They got those ooh guys.
The look on those snakes' faces is just ridiculous. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy. But also here Trumbull says she asks if I'm getting to them, Mr. Trumbull. She says, phew, if you aren't, then they ain't human. Well, no, they ain't human. They're snakes. Oh, right. It's a joke. Never mind. Taking it too seriously. No. But I can't help it. They're not human. They're snakes. I mean,
apparently Sam falls on the snakes, deals with those quickly. But then boa constrictors are dropped in.
Yay.
Oh, dear. I don't know.
Because more snakes.
And as Sam fights them, she's saying, oh, dear, I don't know if motion also distracts boas. But as Trumbull says, try it anyway.
You're being creepy, Trumbull. Cut it out.
Yes, he is.
Cut it out. This is not the time.
And thankfully, well, thankfully, Sam learned how to tie a boa knot in the Boy Scouts.
Yay for puns.
Trumbull was grabbed away while Sam was doing his knot, so they still have to go hunt him down. And there's a whole gag here about him fighting the guards at the zoo. Because they think he's an escaped gorilla until he shows them his license. So like, oh, never mind, he's legit. And they realize, hey, how come he gets a detective license? I had trouble getting a job at the zoo. He must have political connections. I kind of get to know him. Maybe he'll get me sergeant stripes. I mean, there's puns everywhere. I mean, we're not even doing half the puns in here.
No, no. You just have to keep, you just have to let them roll. They roll right along. Let's see. Let's look at his license here. It says state license, private detective Sam Simeon. And he's also got a social security card right next to it.
Yes.
Signature X.
Yeah. Joy.
So there you go.
As he says.
Also note that one of the security guards is reading a karate lesson number one book at the same time as he's in the middle of the fight.
Yes, and he's wishing they'd hurry and send lesson two.
That's right.
Again, this is like a giant Mad Magazine story.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, so they the trail goes to a lion cage, and Sam talks, and Samson speaks to as an animal. He speaks to the lion, and the lion's like, "It's under here, trap door."
Mm-hmm.
And they go in there, and apparently the lion is cool with them being there. Angel even thoughts about asking the lion if they want to be a hippie, which apparently insults the lion.
Yeah, he doesn't want to have beads in his mane. That'd be a lot of work.
I could just wear beads around his neck, maybe.
Yeah, very true. But yeah, it's another another dig at the younger generation as well as what that is there.
Exactly.
So, yeah, well.
And then there's some jaguar, other lions guarding them down there, which apparently don't want to speak to Sam. Mm-hmm. And we got a whole swing and cats thing as he throws them around.
Yeah, Sam's pretty effective. Sam is pretty effective against all these big critters.
Yeah, he's stronger. He's stronger than a normal gorilla, I have to say.
Oh yeah. Well, then some hoods come in.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, sorry, I just gotta say is while he's dealing with them, Angel deals with these hoods. Well, she doesn't really have to deal with them. She just kind of runs through them as they all fall in love with her.
Right. That's one thing on that particular panel is that after going to great lengths to show her, you know, doing some fighting skills and being a badass, here she kind of like just runs past them and they all go flying. And I don't know what they were going to be doing there. It's, of course, it's not important, but I know.
It's like they're
But it is like they're all just like stunned at seeing her. And never mind. I guess we were supposed to stop her, but who cares?
And after she chides Sam for just playing with the cats.
Playing too rough with the poor putties.
But they finally find Trumbull, and whoever's behind it is cooking something.
Mm-hmm.
But Sam knocks him out with the door, and it is the zookeeper. Or it's a zookeeper, one who called Sam an escaped ape. And I gotta go back real quick and see. Yeah, I guess it could be him. His face is not really shown too well.
No, it's not shown very well. But he also is wearing the glasses.
Yeah.
He's wearing the same glasses. I think that's the main thing that's supposed to carry over between the two.
Oh, no, wait a minute. I guess I can see
those overbite.
If you're looking at him on the last panel, page 17, and then jump to the page he's on, we see him knocked out on page 21.
Right. But also his zookeeper outfit is the big green, like full, like a mechanics kind of outfit, right? I don't know what you would call that.
Like coveralls.
It's not, maybe is it coveralls? Okay.
Yeah, kind of like that.
That's what I was getting mistaken. I was thinking overalls. That's right. No, it's coveralls. Yeah, that's what it is. But he's not wearing those here. So and it's fine that he got out of them, but that's one thing that would have clearly made him the zookeeper is that he was wearing the same outfit. And it's like, no.
But
he had time to ditch the coveralls. So,
but Angel figured it out.
Ruins the continuity between the two. That's all. Just kind of doesn't quite give us the continuity between the two scenes.
Yeah, it's like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
But yeah, so Angel figured it out. His foot's healed, and she takes the cast off him very easily, my man. It just kind of slides off. So I'm thinking it's
right.
His leg was already healed when he got the cast put on. Apparently, he was going to steam the cast open. He was not cooking food. He was boiling to steam the cast open because apparently when you unravel it, hidden inside the cast is plans for a rocket.
What?
Yep. Observe.
That's a spy story.
I lined up the strips of tape from the cast, and there you have it, the master plan for a super rocket. Mr. Trumbull was used as a carrier by the so-called Swiss doctor to conceal the plans. But there's a problem.
That's a Scooby-Doo ending all the way.
Well, here's the problem, though. What neither the spies nor the counter-spy knew was that this design is for a new rocket ride at Disneyland.
Complete with very small image of Mickey Mouse's head on one panel, followed by the next one, where they actually name Disneyland by name.
Yes.
They don't use a cop-out imitation name.
No, they say Disneyland and they don't, like five times here.
And they don't make the mouse look like, or call him like Ricky Rat or anything like that. It's like, no, it's definitely Mickey Mouse. It ain't Palisades Park, sweetie.
And apparently this sends him goofy because he's being dragged off in the straitjacket.
Right. But now, here's the thing, is that I was thinking about this. No, you don't really care about this in terms of international government spying. But in terms of corporate espionage, that would be darn valuable.
Yes. If they apparently weren't real spies, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, even if they were, if this was corporate espionage, it still is just as big of a find and probably extremely lucrative kind of information to have to sell to people who are Disney's competitors.
Like Palisades.
So, you know, exactly. And which means, you know, me taking it too seriously. But that's today's eyes go like, oh, yeah, that would be worth big money. Why are they acting like it's a joke? That's big money.
The funny thing is, if you're reading the original issue, on the next page, because the last page of the story is only about a half, only has two panels on the top half of the page. The last half of the page is a giant ad for Palisades Amusement Park.
Yep, which is hilarious. which is a ride that they actually knew about the ads enough to include the joke about that.
Well, I remember seeing a lot ads of Superman in those older issues of Palisades Park. So.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, most of the comics had this thing here you can clip out for a free admission.
Right. Yeah.
But we end with the Trumbull thanking them and giving them his credit at the most exclusive restaurant in town, the Waldorf Ritz, which unfortunately Sam is not dressed up enough for because he's wearing a turtleneck and a kind of looks like a college professor, like that kind of jacket. It's a black tie. He's told it's a strictly black tie, which is what the maitre d' is wearing. So Sam knocks him out and steals his clothes.
Of course, the maitre d's accent is not nearly snooty enough, but that's okay. No.
And he is satisfied because Sam's like, that's much better. See how easy that was? You may go in now, sir. Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Humor. Yeah, what did you think about this story?
It was amusing. Overall. It might have. I sometimes think that, like you said, it's like a Mad story. I do have to think sometimes, though, maybe Mad had a right in where their stories were shorter.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it would have been better to have two stories instead of one big long one with all the jokes and gags and everything like this. Humor, you know, the way humor was depicted is different than, let's say, modern, but we're still talking like 80s, like Justice League International.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, if that's a different style of humor, and that can go for the full issue. I don't know. You know, like Archie stories. Archie generally doesn't have full, you know, especially back at the time, didn't have full issue stories. They'd be like four stories.
Mm-mm. Exactly.
It's just stretching it out. It's like because the complaint my wife has had at times about Saturday Night Live is that a lot of times it feels like, yeah, the skits are funny if they'd ended it 5 minutes before they did.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I do have to wonder if this would have been much more, would have been well more received. I think I might have received it a little better if it was, you know, two stories. What do you think?
Well, I think that if I try to put on the perception of how this would have worked in the day they were writing it, this style of humor was probably up and coming and becoming a big deal because they're doing it in like several books at the same time. So I have a feeling that it probably been the case that the readers at the time wanted longer humor stories rather than shorter ones. Hmm. And just have the contrast because yes, they could get the shorter ones from Archie, but also Archie would be a lot less absurdist. This is very absurd kind of humor. So
it's true.
I kind of think that it works for the length that it is. It tells, and it actually does tell a pretty good story along the way.
I mean, that's true. They do not mean that there is the plot. It does not get mm-hmm. lost.
Yeah. Yeah. They have the plot along the way. We have actually a character. The Angel is really a very interesting character. It's almost like it's almost a shame that's in a humor book because we don't get to find out more of her subtleties along the way. It's going to be glossed over in the effort to make the jokes, you know.
Yes.
But you know, she could be really more interesting. We just don't have a chance to get into it.
And I also have to wonder, with the era that it's from,
mm-hmm.
is how capable Angel is at like beating, you know, like detective work and beating people up, you know, fighting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying this is my opinion. I'm saying, you know, or my thought of it. I'm just wondering if this is what they were trying. Is that one of the jokes?
Right. I think it is.
Is this girl able to do that?
Mm-hmm. No, it absolutely is. That's part of the thing, is that the juxtaposition of the beautiful woman who should be the damsel in distress, and instead, most of the times, is not. So it's absolutely supposed to be playing with those tropes. You know, she is not Lois Lane, who is falling out the window and Sam has to save her. It's like, no, no. But also, we kind of like, they do break it up, at least with having some different scenes to kind of keep the story fresh. And that's why Sam like goes to his apartment, because then we can have a whole bit about Sam having hijinks at his apartment that has nothing to do really with Trumbull. So that's how they kind of like get away with not having it be two distinct stories. It's more like little beats within one story. So I think that kind of works. And it's really fun. I mean, yeah. It's a lot of fun. I mean, when I read it today, it's like, I'm kind of going like, oh, it's a little bit much. You know, the volume of gags and absurdist things that the characters around are saying is not to my taste now, you know, but I can still look at it as a thing of the time and go, oh yeah, I get what they're going for. Yeah. And some of these things work. Some of these things work really well. And I'm just blown away, honestly, by the artwork in this thing. I mean, the detail is incredible. And the volume of sight gags they slip in is just phenomenal. I mean, that's what's amazing to me. It's just, I can marvel at the artwork alone and just go, now, do I really think it's that funny all the way through? Funny-ish, but that was also kind of the taste of the time too, that inoffensive funny-ish. But then they also still slip in things that I feel like they've got some Warner Brothers animation fans in the office who are like, yeah, it was the jokes are over the heads of the kids, but you adults, you know what we're talking about. And the adults are going like, oh yeah, we know what you're talking about. So
I guess it must have sold well enough, because I mean, this is a September 68 cover. Mm-hmm. Angel and the Ape number one is cover dated December 68.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Oh, and plus, by the way,
I mean, Joe Orlando's version of Angel is just, you know, gorgeous. I mean, he just, this woman is amazing. So he sells her very well.
Well, no, this is Bob Oxner.
Oh, that's right. It is Bob Oxner. I don't know.
I'm sorry, I got confused. Inferior Five, I think.
Yes, I was getting it mixed up with the other one. But that works too. But yeah, this Bob Oxner has a big history of drawing beautiful women. So we all know that already. Oh, but yeah, he just makes this work.
Number one, if you remember the cover for issue one of the miniseries, Angel in the Ape number one in the 60s says on right above the Angel in the Ape title, it says, "Who are they? What are they?"
I get it. Yep.
Which is exactly, which is the same cover, you know, words used in the cover of the miniseries.
Right. Of course, they just add, who are they? What are they now? So, oh yeah, that's pretty great.
And of course, now they were not dealing with the case of the missing go-go girls.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I'm wondering if there's some parallels to Gwen Stacy at the same time, around the same time, because she was big in, you know, Spider-Man back then. Oh yeah, she would have been around by now. She would have been in the Spider-Man issues, and she definitely did the go-go dancing with Mary Jane a lot.
Mary Jane like definitely did. I know that.
That blonde hair of Gwen's, that almost white blonde hair of Gwen's, like there's a little bit of a vibe there between her and Angel. So interesting.
Spider-Man was on issue 64.
Yeah. Gwen had been around for a few years by this point.
Oh yeah.
It is time to cover our feedback, and this time we are talking about feedback from episode 190, where John Wilson and I cover the recent miniseries Silver Surfer Rebirth Legacy. And on Facebook, the post about that episode got likes and shares from Rick Heineken, Mirko Mackey, Joe Sedano, Clinton Robinson, Jason Venable, Gene Hendricks, and Ruth Sutherland. On Twitter, we got likes and retweets from Viet Nguyen, Alan Sharp, Doc Strange, Capes and Lunatics Podcast Network, Chris Leiden, Ed Moore, and JohnReadsComics.com. Also, on Blue Sky, we got likes and shares from Maxpocalypse. Now, if you want to hear more from me, there's a few places you can go. Go to Billy D's Magazines and Monsters podcast, and normally you would hear me talking with him about Werewolf by Night, but no, not this month. This month you can hear me talking about an issue of Giant Size Dracula, number 3, in fact. Links will be in the show notes. Also, in case Tim and I did not mention it enough, this episode we are participating in the JL April crossover, which is all about apes, hence JL April, and why we're doing Angel and the Ape. So, just go to whatever social media you like to use, put in the hashtag JL April 2024. You'll see several other episodes that'll pop up that were all part of this crossover, including an episode of The Outcasters where Tim and I talked about the Angel and the Ape 1991 miniseries by Phil Foglio, which actually is kind of funny the way this episode's coming out so late, because that episode came out on the 1st of April, and this episode's coming out on the very last of April, so we're bookending it. Kind of cool. Now, if you aren't able to find all the episodes that way, just go to the Facebook page for the show, and all the episodes have been shared on there. Now, you might be saying, well, how do I find this Facebook page? Here you go. If you want to like and share episodes so you can have your name said here, you want to send me an email or message about the episode, your thoughts about it, well, email resurrectionspodcast@yahoo.com. On Facebook, just type in Adam Warlock or Thanos in search, and it'll pop up. And on Twitter, on Blue Sky, we are at Adam Thanos Pod. And finally, this show is part of The Collective. The Collective was started by a few like-minded podcasters who wanted to network in the most traditional sense. It has become a repository for ideas, crossovers, and potential guest appearances. And here is a promo for one of the other Collective shows right now.
Hey there! Do you like comic books? Do you like superhero TV and movies? Well, come on over and check out the Capes and Lunatics podcast. We have such shows as Capes and Lunatics and Super Connectivity, where we cover everything new and current and popular in the world of superheroes. And we also have episode-by-episode reviews of the Marvel Netflix shows, and a monthly discussion of everything current on the DC Comics character Nightwing, and a few other surprises all the time. So come join us for the Capes and Lunatics podcast.
But yeah, so that was the first appearance of Angel and the Ape.
And it's been riding high ever since. Oh, well, not necessarily, but
it's been there.
It's a solid start. Okay, now here's the other question. Do you think this is intended to be in the DC universe at this time? Or is this just a one-off story, nothing to do with the DC, and not set in the DC universe at all?
See, it's hard to tell back then. Because, I mean, many times Superman stories back in the day almost feel like they're on their own world, too.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think it's meant to be in the DC universe if they decide it is. Because, I mean, a lot of times, like, back then, like, the DC stuff, like I said, Superman stuff, like, Superman, it's almost portrayed like the Superman movie. You know, he's the only one in the world, him and his villains.
Oh, yeah.
It's only in Justice League that you see him interacting with everyone else.
Mm-hmm. You know,
there really was not much of it. I mean, that was one of the big things about Marvel at the time, was that, like, they were in the same city, you know?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, they were called out constantly, and they would have cameos flying by each other.
Mm-hmm.
Here, kind of like everyone was in their own little world, except for the times when they were appearing together.
No, I agree.
So it's kind of hard to answer that question because it's like, only if they wanted, you know, only when, once they decided it would be.
Well, that's, and I think that's fair, is that really that is kind of its answer, is that they wrote these things not intending them to be in a shared universe. Is that that's perfectly fine answer. And that's kind of feels to me, is that when they wrote this story, especially because it was being a humor story, it was not really trying to be part of the broader DCU. And that's fine. It's just an interesting question to ask and think about, considering that we know eventually there'll be cameos of Sam and Angel in things in the DCU much later.
Well, there's also, now I've never read the Ish story, but I think it might be one main story. So because one of their appearances is Showcase 100. They are listed among the featured characters, along with Adam Strange, Anthro, Aquaman, Batlash, the Creeper, the Flash, Green Lantern, Inferior Five, the Metal Man. So basically anyone who appeared in Showcase, the Teen Titans. Now the question is, is this just, are these all like one-page stories, or is this an actual story that features all those characters?
That's a good question. It'd be fun to check it out at some point and see what it has.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that they actually will be interacting with each other, but just from other things I've seen online, but I don't know for sure. And I know for a fact that we do see Angel and perhaps Sam in Crisis on Infinite Earths. They both make appearances in that series.
Oh, yes. Brief appearances, but they
But that's appear. Much later. That's so much later.
But yeah, I mean, if you're looking at appearances for Angel and the Ape, they really only appear pre-Crisis in those two Showcase issues and their own series.
Now, it's also kind of sad when I look at the series itself of Angel and the Ape that it lasts only for 7 issues. The first 6 issues are titled Angel and the Ape, and the last one is titled Meet Angel. But also by issue 4, the cover has Meet Angel, and then in small text, and the Ape. So Sam is still kind of part of the story, but they're shifting the focus more to Angel. Because I think they know which one was the more popular of the two.
It makes me wonder if it ended up becoming more, they were trying to make it more of a humor, you know, like an Archie-style book.
Yeah. Well, like in the last issue, there's Angel on the cover and there's Frankenstein and Dracula chasing after her with a few buzzards flying around as she's strapped to skis. So, But it's kind of a shame that, you know, Sam was kind of losing out along the way.
I'll have to check those. I do want to check those out. Now, so here's a question. Are you interested at all in reading the rest, any more of these books, or is this enough for you?
I think this is enough for me. This might be a rainy day thing about once in a great while, looking up one of those issues, but I don't think I want to have a deep read of all this, of this whole series, just because I kind of already get the gist of what the comedy is going to be like. So like, okay, that's fine. The story was serviceable, but not enough to really grip me. So it's like, it's fine. But how about yourself? Would you want to be continuing to read more?
Although I am curious, like, how much, like, what happens to Showcase 100? You know, is that a story, like, are they interacting with the Teen Titans and the others or not?
Right.
And then also, like, what happens, like, do they go away from the private investigator and more just cute girl and her gorilla friend?
Mm-hmm.
And does Angel's abilities get downplayed as it goes or not? So I kind of want to read them because I kind of want to see how it goes. Like, what do they do with it?
Oh, yeah, that's fair. I mean, I'm not going to say, you're wrong. What are you doing? That's wrong. Well, I mean, who wouldn't like to read an anniversary issue of Showcase with all those guest stars in it? I mean, that's the selling point more than anything else. I'd want to read that just for its own sake and less for seeing if there's going to be humor for Angel and the Ape. Reading their series is going to be more about the humor of the continuing this kind of humor is what they're going to have. It's like, it's fine. It's fine.
I also want to see how they change it because here's the thing. I did find after we did our miniseries coverage and I kind of skimmed through and read a bit like the first issue of the Vertigo miniseries.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I read that. Mm-hmm.
Reading that now and reading this one finally, the Angel's characterization, from what I remember, kind of seems more like this.
Yeah, that's fair.
He's going more off of what the original one was.
Well, and also there was a lot of sexualization in that particular series.
Well, there's that too. Of course, there is that.
But so, again, that also plays into what they were doing here. It's just here there's much more of a wink and a nod.
Well, yeah, that's a Vertigo.
There was,
so, you know.
And the Vertigo is in your face.
Yeah.
For mature readers. Or immature readers who are old enough. I guess that's what it is.
Exactly. Or immature readers whose comic store doesn't give a damn.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, I'll sell it to you. Right. You're going to pay me the $1.95, kid. I don't give a damn. Get out of here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Resurrections, an Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast, is a fan-made production, and no copyright infringement is intended or happening or even understood. The opening music for this podcast is Intro Pompeii by Lino Rise, and the closing music is Dark and Dramatic by DJ Puzzle. Both are licensed by the Creative Commons license. You can find Lino Rise at free-intro-music.com and DJ Puzzle at peacelovproductions.com. Links to both can be found on the Tumblr page.
Facebook. Just type in Adam Warlock or Thanos in the search box Facebook. Just type in Adam Warlock or Thanos in the search part and